Welcome, welcome, welcome back. Welcome back, people. I'm your host, Alexa Wilkinson.
And I'm your co-host, Mia Fiorito.
And this is Drink History. Welcome, welcome, welcome back. Today on the show, Mia is going to school us on the history of the Bee's Knees cocktail and its creator.
The Bee's Knees.
And later on the episode, we will be speaking with distiller and owner of Bimini Gin, Christina Hansen, who will give us the inside scoop on what it takes to be a gin distiller and how COVID has reshaped her business model.
Mm-hmm.
A good convo. Mia, guess what?
What?
I did something really crazy.
What did you do? Tell
I didn't research this at all. I've been waiting patiently.
Nothing?
For you. Nothing.
Oh, okay.
Patiently for you to tell me about the Bee's Knees.
I'm excited for it. I will say that I got lost in more of the history behind the man who created it than I actually did it itself because I feel like the history behind it, like, when I was looking up for, like, the Bee's Knees, I didn't feel like I found much about the cocktail. Once I heard the man who made it, Frank Meyer, I'm just going to say his name. Once I found out about him, I was like, oh, who is he? Because, like, everyone was talking about the Bee's Knees and, like, the phrase, where it came from and that and, like, how different honeys that you use can bring out different flavors or
so what? Essentially, like, the Bee's Knees is sort of one of those cocktails that depending on the ingredients you use together, they can sort of, you're not going to have like two Bee's Knees alike unless you go to a bar that emulates a recipe from the other one. It's
pretty much, because I feel like when you get certain honeys from somewhere, or if you get, like, if you're using agave versus honey, sometimes certain honeys tend to have a little bit more of like a floral taste to them. So it might enhance that within the gin. But some honeys also, it was on this website that I was just reading about, like, how to make it. And that's what they were saying. They were saying that the honey, because that was like the reason why it's called the Bee's Knees, really does play a huge part in what kind of honey you're using and who it's from and the producer and blah, 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 blah.
Interesting.
So I didn't really find too much about, like, that like, on the Bee's Knees. But I did really like how everyone always thinks that the Bee's Knees is, like, a term for, like, excellence or, like, something being, like, great or outstanding. Like, that's the Bee's Knees. But in the late 1700s, the expression the Bee's Knees was actually used to describe things that were really small and insignificant because, like, that's like how little the bee's knee, like the bee, that's the bee's knees. Like,
it, they have the teeniest knees.
Exactly. So people would actually in the 1700s use it as, like, not an insult, but it wasn't what we think of when we hear bee's knees. It was completely opposite.
Interesting.
Yeah, right. And it wasn't until around like 1920 that the bee's knees became something awesome.
So for 300 years, it meant something the opposite of how we use it now. That's so funny.
Isn't that cool?
That's cool. I didn't know that. So the cocktail, so we made our own Bee's Knees. And let's just talk about that briefly because you mentioned honey.
Yes.
I used a raw Hudson Valley honey for the syrup. So because we used Bimini, their coconut gin, I wanted to keep it on brand for the episode. I used the Bimini coconut gin, and I wanted to sort of like play off of those tropical flavors in the coconut gin. Just as a side note with the coconut gin, it's not like Malibu-y. And when we're talking about coconut, you can barely taste it. It's just this like essence of coconut, and it's really, it's more creamy than it is anything else. So back to the recipe. So I did a coconut water, raw honey, thyme syrup, fresh squeezed lemon juice, muddled golden gooseberry, muddled mint, and muddled thyme. Mix that all together with the coconut gin. Shook it up for actually for like 20 to 25 seconds. Mm-hmm. And then I strained that in with a mesh strainer into a coupe glass.
It is outstanding.
It's really good.
I never thought that coconut gin
yeah, would be a thing.
So straight. That's the first time I've ever heard of a gin with that like coconut essence. Like, where did that come from? Like,
yeah, I'm excited to hear her process of how she got to the coconut part of that, because I've never seen a coconut gin. So
this has to be the first one.
It might be the first one. Well, we'll find out more when we talk to Christina. I'm excited. Anyway, okay, so back to the business.
Yes.
So Mia, tell us. Ready? Are you ready?
And I am ready. Okay. So the bee's knees is thought to have been emerging, like coming out about like during the Prohibition era in America, when bathtub gin was like a huge big thing. But it was created by this man named Frank Meyer. And who is Frank Meyer? So Frank Meyer was an Austrian-born, part-Jewish bartender who was the first, like, head bartender at the Ritz in Paris in 1921 when its cafe – I'm not sure if I'm going to say this right. I'm going to spell it because you're better with words. But I would say it's Parisian, but it's
Parisian.
Parisian. Okay.
Yeah.
So I don't even need to spell it. I'm so bad with words.
It's like if you were to call – it's like if you were to say someone's a New Yorker, like a Parisian is someone
Cafe
from Paris.
Cafe Parisian.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, that's cool.
Just, yeah. Thank Cafe, you. Cafe, a person from Paris.
I clearly need to go back to school. But so in 1921, that's when that cafe had like opened. And according to your man, David Wandrish, I just want to throw that out there because you quote him a lot. And I was very
proud. He's my man.
I know. I was very proud to find a little quote. He said that Frank actually trained at this legendary bar in New York's Hoffman House Hotel, which was on Madison Square in 1903. And this gave Frank Meyer like credit as a bartender. Like, he had a glowing resume after this. He was the dude. And after establishing his rep as a dope ass bartender in America, Meyer ended up fleeing over to Paris to escape Prohibition. And so when I heard that, so a lot of like rich Americans also started to go to Paris, and it kind of like sparked my eyeballs, because when I was reading this, because I didn't hear it, so it didn't spark
my
ears. It sparked my
eyeballs.
It gave me a little twinkle in my eye, because I was remembering how Todd Sloan was an American jockey. So he obviously was higher in the ranks of like money, I would assume. And he fled to Paris and opened up that New York bar. So I feel like it kind of goes hand in hand with, but he ended up going, what was the date for
it was
Sloan?
Like the 1918. It was not
right
when Prohibition came about.
Right.
So
that's right. And then, and then Harry's New York Bar actually became Harry's New York Bar, I believe, in 1921.
Yeah. So this is all around the same time.
Yeah. So
these things are happening simultaneously.
Right. So that one person who had mentioned, I forget who mentioned that the Front 75 was pre-Prohibition. When I read that, I was like, oh, wow. Yeah, she was right. Because Todd Sloan opened up before Prohibition. It confirms what she was saying, that it's a pre-Prohibition for the Front 75. But, so, Frank Meyer, this is interesting and fun for me. So, when he wasn't busy, like, doing his bartender thing at the cafe, what did you say again?
Parisian.
Yeah. So, when he's, I'm just going to say at the Ritz. We're going to say at the Ritz.
Just say at the Ritz.
At the Ritz. So when he wasn't doing his little cocktail thing and shaking and doing his thing, he was an active role in the French resistance. And I was like, whoa. So what he was doing was that he was actually passing fake IDs to the Jewish residents at the hotel at the time so that they could dodge concentration roundups from the government.
Oh my God.
And right. And he also was kind of like this messenger guy for Nazi officers who planned on assassinating Hitler, actually. Oh. How cool is that?
Dude, that's insane.
Yeah. And so Meyer apparently wasn't even the only one who was in on it. Pretty much like 90% of the entire staff at the Ritz was involved in this resistance. How cool is that?
So, you know, just cooking up legacy era cocktails.
Yeah.
Saving Jewish people from concentration camps. Wow, what right. a total badass.
Yeah.
Total package.
Right. So then as I'm doing my research, I come across this quote by François Monti, author of 101 Cocktails to Try Before You Die. It's a reference book on the history of cocktails. So he says, and I quote, "We have yet to determine the exact nature of his involvement," Meyer, we're talking about his involvement, "but the portrait is credible since the Ritz was one of the only hotels that could still welcome civilians and was simultaneously being used by the occupying forces. The bartender's role was actually very, very crucial because he was the one who was, and now this is like my words, but like he was the one on the front lines of all the information. Like he could hear everything that everyone was saying because
absolutely.
He was serving the cocktails.
Yeah. Side and note, then, by the way, bartenders absolutely mm-hmm. hear what you're talking about.
Right.
You think you're having a quiet fight with your partner. We can hear you. We know when you're mm-hmm. having a bad date. We know when you're about to get laid. We know we know everything about your conversations, which mm-hmm. is why we're actually, I'm just saying, we're a good resource for gossip.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I think bartenders are kind of like, we don't take it outside of work.
Right.
I don't like go home and like, you
talk
know,
about your
talk about a customer at the bar's private business. So I'm just saying.
Right.
Anyway, back
we
to.
We hear it all. Just like Meyer did.
Just like Meyer.
But we're not Meyer. We're not messengers.
No, so, nothing of that great importance.
I just found like that whole entire storyline of him so cool because fuck the Nazis. So
yep.
Yeah. So there's also just like kind of confirming that Meyer was actually a part of this whole resistance. I also have another quote from Tilar Mazzeo, author of The Hotel on Place Vendôme, Life, Death, and Betrayal at the Hotel Ritz in Paris, writes, and I quote, "The primary sources confirming this theory are documents from the German police force in Berlin, and having your name listed anywhere on these documents meant that you were in danger." And Mazzeo explains, "Frank Meyer was under Gestapo surveillance, and they suspected him to be kind of a mailbox transferring messages from the Ritz to the German resistance. And they knew that he had distant Jewish roots, and so they, you know, figured that he was working against the interests of Nazi Germany." So that
spoiler
just kind
alert.
Of
he was.
Yeah. So that kind of just like confirms like him being on those paper documents and all that. Confirms that.
Was he ever caught?
Did
your research find that he
okay,
was ever caught?
Okay, so apparently Frank Meyer actually gets fired from this hotel and ends up, because he was like having patrons pay him. It was like this quick thing that I read. He was having patrons pay him direct, like their tabs directly to his banking accounts.
Hmm.
Right. So
which
he
I'm
then
pretty
like
sure
gets
is
fired.
Technically embezzlement.
Yeah, right.
Is that
so
right?
He then like yeah, so they did it cost him his job. According to Field, this guy Field, on this website, he had taken on instructing some of his clients to pay their tabs to his private London bank account. And it says on here that subsequently, he was supposed to pay off their debts, but he never did. And when the hotel found out about this, that was just like the end of Frank. He disappeared. I love this quote. Like a spy, he melted away into the night. Some claim that he popped up later in the south of France and passed away in 1947. So he passed away in
South France.
Yeah, in 1947. How old
was he when he fled America during Prohibition to then bartend subsequently through World War II?
Okay, so...
Is he an older fellow? I would imagine, though, that he was probably in like his 40s or 50s when he fled. Because I've noticed a very consistent trend of about like Prohibition era bartenders is that they were like old dudes, like super old dudes. There wasn't like the younger bartender trend that there is now.
Yeah, like in all these pictures that I see of him actually pouring drinks, he looks old.
He was an older dude.
Yeah.
So let's say for argument's sake, he was probably like in his 60s or 70s when he passed away. That probably makes sense.
Yeah, makes sense. I'm glad that he didn't get caught for anything, and like even
Me
though
too,
he was
man.
Doing a little bit of embezzlement or whatever, like I'm glad you didn't do that. He also ended up. This is another quote from Francois. This is like an ender, I guess, on the Frank conversation. But Francois says that Frank Meyer is a sacred figure, even though most bartenders have forgotten about him. He's a founding member and former president of the ABF, Association of Bartenders of France, and represents the professionalization of bartending in France. For a time, his students who succeeded him at the Ritz kept his philosophy alive, and Frank Meyer was a very 1930s character, colorful but discreet, a mix of folklore and professionalism. I really like that quote. So Frank Meyer also wrote a book, and the Bee's Knees was in that book. It was like a bunch of cocktails that he had made at the time. And it was really hard to find any copies of this book, and it wasn't until just recently that it finally was republished, because I think there was like 26
copies.
It says there were 1,026 copies, and 26 were reserved for just him himself. And it says that online barware Emporium Cocktail Kingdom now sells a faithful reprint with an additional by Field.
Yeah, The Artistry of Mixing Drinks is what it's called.
Yeah, it came out in 1936. But for a while, it was like hard
apparently
to get.
Oh my God, of course it was. Like, this is just a revival of people trying to bring this stuff back. I'm totally going to buy this book. You know me, I buy all the books.
I think it's so cool.
Saving.
I know. I just love his story.
Yeah,
like,
he
you
is
get
a
it.
Dope dude.
Yeah.
He's a dope dude. That's a history. And I'm not, you know, I'm not a fan of the embezzlement, but there could be a different reason why he did that, you know. Might not have been malicious. Maybe he was trying to save up money to help bring people to safety.
Right.
Then that was the only way he could think to do it quickly. That would make sense. I feel like that's on brand for him. I'm going to make up a version of Frank Meyer history that he's like some fucking superhero where he's saving money, tapping into the rich patrons, and he's just like, all right, the best you can do is fire me.
Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah, good for him.
You know, as I farther read into where he got fired, it actually says right here that if one were to speculate, you can see that if you were risking your life engaging in resistance to the degree that the Gestapo was watching you, thinking of ways to make more money for a Swiss family who are certainly German sympathizers on the face of it, it would be hard to be like, I'm going to go pass them more money. And that's actually by Mazzeo, too. That's interesting. You could see why somebody might embezzle.
Absolutely.
So.
Absolutely.
This dude's just trying to. I mean, that's so, like, imagine that being your life. Like, you're, like, trained in America, and you have, like, such a high rep working at this awesome bar, and then all of a sudden Prohibition starts being a thing. So then you flee to France, and you just, like, happen to work at this awesome hotel and become, with a lot of your coworkers, this, like,
part of the resistance.
Yeah, like a bartender, like a pillar of resistance.
That was a very clear decision that he made to, like, do this thing. He could have gotten arrested, put in jail, killed.
I think
more than likely killed.
Yeah, he would have been executed.
It begs the question, like, if there was ever something that happened like that again, would the bartenders of today be brave enough to do that? I would hope so. It. Oh, you doubt it?
I highly doubt it.
I would do it.
I would love to be a part of something like that. It'd be so scary. It would be so scary. But when you're doing something like...
You don't mean that you would love a scenario to emerge in which you would have the opportunity. If something was happening like that, outside of your control.
Right. I would have so much pride in being part of a resistance to something so horrible. Like, and not getting caught? Like, what?
He kind of got caught. He kind of got caught.
He only got caught for embezzlement. Like, he only got caught for having people send him their money to his personal bank account. Like, it's like, Venmo me your bill. You know what I mean? Like, why don't you just Venmo me instead of actually paying the restaurant? Just, you know, send me the Venmo. And you're just making this money. And it's like, you're supposed to be paying off the debt for people, but you're not. Meanwhile, you're also like this dope ass person who's like this secret. How could you be the bartender at this hotel that's huge, this huge hotel, because civilians are going there as well as armed forces. Everyone's allowed to be in there. And because I feel like around that time, like, I would assume that like Nazi Germany officers, I would assume they would shut down bars to the public if they're ever meeting anywhere. So for that even to be a thing is wild in its own, that was still, like, that was allowed to happen.
Yeah, when the Germans occupied France, they absolutely took over businesses. And they absolutely, especially Jewish businesses, and they absolutely, yeah, you're correct. They would shut places down. So what I like about the quote from Mezzo is that it's very clear that, like, Frank Meyer had a very clear intention in his embezzlement. And it's that we're open, you're sympathizing with the Nazis. Mm-hmm. It's like, you're automatically in that group. So even the reason that he was allowed to work and stay open and be a part of that, I love that he had such conviction. And he had such a purpose of what he was doing day to day, and such a sort of a, you don't think of bartending back then as like an essential job. You think of, like, during between World War I and the end of World War II, you think of, like, factory workers, soldiers, you don't think of bartenders as being these, like, essential jobs. But then when you frame it in that context of they overhear every conversation at the bar, they're inconspicuous passengers of vital information, or not passengers, they're inconspicuous messengers and carriers of vital information.
And you don't even as a bartender, like, I don't need to be standing in front of you to be able to hear or understand what you're saying. Like, I could go walk over to the dishwasher and be polishing glasses, and I can tune it out and and be paying attention to what you're saying. So
yeah,
the bartender being that front man,
super spy shit.
Right. I thought that was so cool, Mr. Spy.
But you have this whole complicated scenario of Frank doing all this, and then you have this incredibly simple cocktail of lemon.
I know. Isn't that crazy?
He's like, I have a lot of other shit to do. Three ingredients, go.
Yeah. Honey.
Honey's good. Sweet. Throw it in there.
Yeah.
Ran out of sugar.
Yeah.
But it's a delicious cocktail. So thank you, Frank. And thank you for all the work you did. I'm sorry you didn't get more credit throughout the years. So while we were talking, I looked up the recipe in The Artistry of Mixing Drinks.
Nice.
And it says, in a shaker, the juice of 1/4 lemon, a teaspoon of honey, 1/2 glass, 1 ounce of gin, shake well and serve.
There you go.
Very simple. But I do like that we've gotten away from the wine glass measurement, the rhyming schemes of recipe. Like, it's a very clear recipe. But I also like the ambiguity of 1/2 glass, even though it's put and clarified in the recipe on the Daily Beast article on the website, 1 ounce. What glass?
Mm-hmm.
You know, am I filling half the glass with gin?
Right. Exactly. I mean, if someone writes
open to one interpretation.
Half, yeah, if someone writes one half glass, I mean, my glass of choice will be half full.
And for you, that's a soup mug.
Yeah. That's as big as my head.
Yeah. As big as your head. So one bee's knees, accordance with Mia's measurement standard, and she is good lit. To go. She's good to go.
I am the bee's knees after that.
So bee's knees, mm-hmm. super simple ingredients.
Yeah.
Frank Meyer, the badass spy bartender, mm-hmm. dope-ass dude who invented it in his book that we now have a revitalization of and we're able to order online, which absolutely I'm going to do that.
Yeah, I want to get it too myself.
We should both get a copy.
Mm-hmm.
So that is fascinating. I love that story. But what I'm really excited to learn more about is about gin distilling.
Yeah.
And so coming up, we're going to talk to Christina Hansen, who is the owner and GM and distiller of Bimini Gin and also Round Turn Distilling. That's where they make the gin. So we're going to hear more about that. So with that, we're going to take a quick break.
I love this.
And when we come back.
I love it.
And when we come back, we're going to talk to Christina about gin.
Woo-hoo!
See you in a bit. Peanut butter. You love it, right? Okay, us too. But have you had Noumi peanut butter? All right, let me tell you about Noumi. So before that first spoonful, you may think that Noumi is just another brand of peanut butter, but give it a try and you'll experience a dazzling new flavor that's putting peanut butter on a whole other level. Noumi's award-winning signature blend of organic peanut butter is made with just 5 ingredients and sweetened with dates. It's a naturally perfect balance of sweet and salty. And as a personal fan of this peanut butter, I can tell you it's like nothing I've ever tried before. There's no palm oil, no added sugar here, just organic and all-natural ingredients that are better for you and the environment. That's right, a sustainable, clean-label peanut butter that's the perfect pantry addition for peanut butter lovers of all ages to devour and delight. So what are you waiting for? Visit NoumiBrand.com and use the code DRINKPB15 for 15% off your online order. That's NoumiBrand.com for 15% off your online order. Supplies are limited, so scoop up Noumi peanut butter today. Hello and welcome back. Today we have with us the founder, co-owner, distiller, and GM, 4 awesome things, of Bimini Gin and Round Turn Distilling, Christina Hansen.
Christina.
Hello.
Welcome to Drink History. We're so happy to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
Yeah, on this snowy day where you found some warmth in your retail section of your distillery.
Yes. Yeah, no, it's nice. A giant former textile mill, so it has like 18-foot ceilings and everything's made of brick, so it's, you know,
cold.
Always yeah. cold. It's always cold or really hot depending on the time of year. So
big right. brick buildings are known for their good insulation, so I don't know what you're complaining
definitely.
About.
Definitely.
Yeah. All right, so I have a first question for you. You and Darren, who is your partner, husband?
Husband, yep. We've been married about 6 years.
Husband, okay,
yeah.
Just wanted to make sure. I figured I creeped on you on Instagram a little bit, but oh, yeah. I didn't want to assume. Some people are just partnered and not married. And
sure. Know, we were partnered for a very long time and then got married because we could save some money on our taxes. So
there you go.
It's
all about the tax break. Exactly. Yeah. Cool. So you've been open for over 5.5 years now.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Can you tell us a little about your journey into gin and what prompted you to start distilling?
Yeah, definitely. So my husband and I are originally from southern Maine. I grew up in neighboring towns. And we had been living down in New York for a number of years. He was working in advertising. I was working in the fashion industry. And we were getting a little burnt out, getting ready to move back home. Both of our families are still up here. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, more accessible access to nature and the ocean, which we both grew up by, was really a big part of our lives growing up. And so we thought if we moved back home, we'd probably want to start our own business. And so we looked to our hobbies, which living in New York had become eating and drinking on the weekends. And we had really gotten into the craft cocktail culture that was happening. It was sort of a resurgence of, you know, craft spirits and quality ingredients in the late 90s, early 2000s. And it was definitely still developing when we were down there. And so we, you know, would spend our weekends going out, sitting at the bar, talking to bartenders about new spirits they were excited about, learning about different categories of spirit, liqueurs, Amari, things like that. And it was just something that we both found really interesting as just a hobby and also as a, you know, food and drink experience. And so we started learning a little bit more about craft distilling, visited a few distilleries here in Maine, one out in California, and just did a lot of research. Took about a year and a half, 2 years worth of asking questions, reading, and then we just decided to go for it and open our own space.
Wow.
My okay.
A quick question.
Yeah,
when
yeah.
you were out and you were obviously enjoying like the food and drinks part of everything of New York, were you ordering gin drinks? Like, was that like your liquor of choice then too? Or did you have like what made you go into gin specifically?
Yeah. So we, I don't know, when we first started getting into this stuff, we were both very much like cocktail virgins. We didn't know a whole lot about the history or, you know, I was sort of stumped unless I was ordering like a Cosmo or like a Jack and Coke or something. Like that was sort mm-hmm. of the limit of my knowledge. And so that was another thing that we definitely got out of our experience talking to other industry professionals was just learning from them. And being able to experiment, like, you know, ask about what this particular ingredient is on this cocktail menu that we've never heard of before and get an idea of the flavor profile and then try it and be able to have conversations about it. Just learn how some of these flavors keep appearing in particular spirits or recipes. And so for gin specifically, I kind of had a, I don't know, family connection. Gin is the only spirit my dad drinks. And my mom doesn't drink at all. So that's really the only thing. I remember he would always get a gin and tonic when we went out to dinner at places. And being, you know, 90s kids, my sisters and I would always fight about who got to chew on his cocktail straws after he was done. And so, you know, because they like tasted like lime. It was sweet lime. It was great.
Yeah.
I'm sure there wasn't that much alcohol left in it. So he didn't seem to care that much. But so.
That's so funny.
So he definitely had somewhat of a connection to gin. But as far as opening a distillery and making the product ourselves, we always thought gin was the most interesting spirit to pursue in that sense. Mostly because you have such a wide range of flavors and botanicals you're able to use. It really has the most opportunity for creativity. Right. So as long, even just legally speaking, as far as the TTB is concerned, as long as juniper is the dominant botanical in the gin, you can pretty much add in whatever other flavors you want. There's no limits to the different flavors that you can get into your botanical blend. So it seems to be the trend now that a lot of craft spirits are trying to stand out, particularly in the gin category, by having a really strong flavor profile that sort of centers around one spice or botanical. A lot of times it's like cardamom or something more floral like lavender. In our instance, we wanted something that was a little more citrusy. So we use grapefruit and hops, a little bit of chamomile too. So you get some nice sort of flowery, soft citrus notes, but it's also nice and bright.
I love it. Which hop varietal are you using?
We use Mount Hood.
Nice.
Yeah, we chose that one specifically. We wanted something that was right in the middle. It was sort of equal parts aromatic and flavoring. We didn't want anything that was too, you know, dank, for lack of a better word. Like there's some really there's some really heavy ones out there. So yeah, we wanted one that was a little bit lighter. So it's a transplant of the Hallertauer hop that's in a lot of German pills, Czech pills, things like that. And so it's just a sort of lighter, cleaner flavor. It's not too resinous. That's the flavor that we did want to specifically try to avoid in the gin. A lot of people have associations with, you know, that sort of sharp pine flavor in the background, or like a sort of acrid aftertaste. And so hops can have a similar effect because they have that resin quality to them. So we wanted something that was definitely a little bit lighter, a little more palatable, easy to drink.
Very cool.
Nice. So, Mia, did you have a question about – did she answer your question?
Yeah.
We sort of talked earlier about what we wanted to ask you. Did she answer your question about what is in the gin? Or
yep.
She...
So I also was just – is it – you definitely have different because Alexa was making Bee's Knees. That's going to be the cocktail of this episode with – a coconut gin.
Mm-hmm.
And what were you, like, what was going through your mind, like, when you were making the coconut element of it?
Yeah, so we're really excited about the coconut. It's our newest expression. We have four products all together. We started with the original gin, and then 2 years ago we introduced at the same time an overproof version and a barrel rested version. And then this year we launched the coconut, which is flavored with organic, fair trade certified, extra virgin coconut oil. And so what inspired that was we had seen a lot of bartenders, particularly around here and in New York, using the fat wash process to add coconut flavor to our gin. And it always seemed to be coconut. I know that the sort of cocoa blast thing was hot for a little while a couple of years ago. But we wanted to bring that into the home cocktail experience. So it's a bit of a sort of messy, involved process working with coconut oil. It's solid at room temperature, which makes it a little bit tricky. So particularly up in Maine, where room temperature is lower than it might be in other places. So for that one, it's a really nice dry coconut flavor. We don't use any extracts or extra flavorings, nothing artificial. It's just the coconut oil. And so what happens is over the week-long infusion that we do, the botanical oils from distillation are just all the essential oils that have come out of the botanicals. And so that's what gives gin its flavor and aroma, is just essential oil. And then it's suspended in the alcohol in solution. And so alcohol being a solvent, it helps pull the flavor out of the coconut oil, and the oils bond together and sort of develop the flavor in a really nice rounded way. So once we do strain off the coconut oil, some of those flavor compounds have been absorbed into both the alcohol and the other botanical oils. So it's nice and balanced and right in line with the other flavors that we use. So it's a nice little tropical twist in the background. It's not, it's nothing artificial, so it's not hitting you over the head. It doesn't taste synthetic in any way, but it's just
it's
a nice.
It's not Malibu-y.
Exactly, yeah, that's what I tell people. It's not Malibu, yeah.
It's not, and when I was using it for the recipe, because I went down to Brooklyn to grab a bottle and they didn't have the regular gin.
Oh, no.
So I was you know what? No worries. I'm going to get the coconut. I'm going to do something fun with it. So I'm going to tell you the recipe that I did. I actually used coconut water and honey together to make a syrup.
Yes. Yeah.
I steeped, I infused it with thyme.
Ooh.
I then got golden gooseberries and I muddled them with thyme and mint.
Wow.
I added fresh lemon juice, the syrup, and then the gin, and I muddled that all together and I shook it for like 20 seconds to like really get the mint.
Yeah.
It's so subtle, but it's so subtle. It's like you think you hear all that flavor and you think it's going to be intense. It's really not. It's as subtle as like a normal Bee's Knees would be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow. I love the coconut gin. I think it's my new obsession.
Thank you so much.
So I'm really glad you made it, because it's so understated. When my wife tried it when we first brought it home, she's like, I can't wait to try this gin. I'm so excited. She opened it up and she was like, I don't know what I was expecting. I was expecting Malibu, but gin. And I was like, I told you it's not. And she was like, this is like, I could sip on this. And I was like, that's good. That's what it's there for. We're going to sip on this.
Oh, that's awesome.
Kudos on the coconut gin.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Yeah. So when you're talking about all this process of gin making and you're talking about oil extraction from the alcohol and the oils bonding and things I don't know necessarily that much about. How did you get into the research and like the actual step of moving you and your husband into this territory of like starting to distill? Because that's a really big jump that not a lot of people make.
It is a big jump, and it's tricky with distilling particularly because there is no small scale alternative. Like it's against federal law to distill alcohol at home. Like you're not allowed to do it unless you're a fully licensed distilled spirits plant like we are.
Thanks, Prohibition.
Seriously, yeah. Neil Dow, actually, who wrote the Volstead Act, is from Portland, Maine. He used to be the mayor there. So sorry, everybody. It's our fault.
Damn you, Neil.
Yeah. Anyway. So for us, it really started with just reading several books. We found a lot of books on the process of distilling that were actually published pre-prohibition, because the technology really hasn't changed that much. It's just basic physics. You're just boiling water and alcohol in a enclosed environment and collecting the vapor that comes off the top. But we also, when we figured out specifically that we wanted to make gin, our research for the recipe started in our apartment using just mason jars and grain neutral spirit. So our neighborhood in Brooklyn had a really large Polish population. And so all the little corner liquor stores carried this Polish neutral spirit, basically an Everclear. They've stocked it because it was, you know, like at Christmas time, they'd soak stone fruit in it to make liqueur. And it was this traditional thing. But for our purposes, that's the basis for most gins. In the, you know, most simple sense, you could describe gin as a flavored vodka. You're just flavoring the alcohol through the process of distillation rather than adding flavors in after the fact. Mm-hmm. And so our initial research started with just doing individual infusions of herbs and spices and plants in this neutral alcohol to see what sort of flavors we could extract. So it's not exactly the same. But once we did find a recipe that we liked, we were just using medicine droppers to mix different ratios of these different infusions to try and find a nice, clean sort of summery profile. That's what we wanted the gin to be. We wanted it to reflect the, you know, memories of summer we had growing up on the coast of Maine. Just something really refreshing that you want to drink in the sun on the beach or on a boat or something like that. That was sort of the experience we wanted everything to invoke. So
on the tennis court with grandma.
Yes, exactly. Well, I mean, some of these coastal towns are, you know, bedroom communities for millionaires, but that's not my life. So, we're just doing these different, infusions with the mason jars, mix them together, you know, like 4 drops of this, 5 drops of this. And then once we finally nailed down the flavor profile we thought we wanted to go with, we actually bought a little stovetop still. It's basically a modified stock pot. I know. Yeah. Don't try this at home, kids. So then we distilled each botanical individually just to see what flavors would be extracted through distillation rather than just infusion. And once we had those, then we started the process all over again of tweaking the ratios, seeing, you know, what flavors came through at what temperatures and narrowing it down that way to really dial into the exact flavor we wanted. And so once we did that, then we were able to scale up to our industrial equipment. And thankfully, because of the process we went through, the act of scaling up really didn't require that much of a tweak to our recipe. Mm-hmm. So we were able to, you know, go from 1 liter to, you know, 400 gallons pretty easily. So thankfully.
Wow.
400 gallons. I'm like,
Yeah.
So much.
In like the world of distribution and like actual alcohol making, spirit making, I feel like that's not that many gallons.
so tiny. It, yeah. But
to us, it's like this whole room.
Yeah.
Full of gin.
Yeah.
Because we're just, we don't know. We don't do it. So you made these infusions. You're coming to this place of developing a recipe. What was the next step in your process? Like, what happened after that? Now you have your recipe. You've got everything going. What's the next step?
Yeah. So sort of simultaneously, while we were doing these experiments and research, we had begun the process of getting our space opened in Maine. So we were still living in New York. We were both still working. We were coming up on the weekends. And we had found the space that we're in now. We had initially looked up in Portland. That's where the sort of population density is for Southern Maine. But honestly, even 7 years ago, it was still way too expensive for what we were looking to do. So we started looking a little bit further out from there. And there's this, you know, town, a couple towns over from where we both grew up called Biddeford. And it's an old mill town. The mills were in here. It's a 150-year-old textile mill. They used to make wool blankets. It's right on the river. Aww. It's really pretty. Yeah,
so it's wholesome.
It's a huge complex, too. It's about 1 million square feet altogether, with like 16 buildings or something. So we got in touch with them. And what was unique about it for us was we needed industrial zoning, essentially. We're hazardous material manufacturers. That's what we're licensed to do. So, you know, zoning code can be a little bit tricky. And a lot of the stuff we were finding was, you know, just in industrial parks, wrong side of the highway kind of thing. But these mills, based on the history here, they're on Main Street in downtown. You know, like City Hall is two blocks that way. The police station is one block that way. The fire station is four blocks that way. Like, it's right in the center of town. Wow. And so for us, it was a really unique opportunity because it was total mixed zoning. So industrial, retail, residential, it's all in the same complex. And our specific space here, we are literally on Main Street. I can see Main Street out the windows. So from a retail perspective, having a tasting room, it was really an easy way for us to get engaged with our community here. You know, because we're not some faceless warehouse in an industrial park no one's going to go to, where, you know, people are walking up and down the street to go to the library or get a cup of coffee or something like that. So it's really allowed us to be engaged with the downtown community, which has really helped revitalize the town. It was pretty depressed during the period when I was a kid growing up. I think the mill officially closed back in the 80s, but it had been, you know, a huge bustling, you know, quote unquote city for Maine. It's pretty small. It's only about 20,000 people. But in the 80s and 90s, it was not somewhere you wanted to be. Main Street was just all vacancies, and there's a lot of high unemployment, drug problem, crime problem. But honestly, in the last 6 or 7 years, mainly because of the mills here being redeveloped and the rest of Main Street sort of following in its footsteps, it's really had a resurgence of small business, and it's really revitalized the downtown. It's a completely different place than it was to when I grew up. It's really great.
That's fantastic. So they were happy to have you come and put a distillery and a tasting room.
They were, imagine. You know, family friendly.
Yeah. Of course. Exactly. Gin for everyone.
Yeah.
Cool. So now you have this recipe, you have the space, you move up there, you start full force. I noticed on your website you have a cocktail menu that you guys have developed. What do you think about the Bee's Knees, the cocktail that we're covering? Is that sort of like a base for some other cocktails that you've made, or do you just like, what do you think about the Bee's Knees?
Yeah, the Bee's Knees is great. We here have always sort of skewed towards classic cocktails for a number of reasons. We think it's, you know, a really good introduction for people who are not necessarily familiar with gin, but also just from a legal perspective, what we're allowed to sell here as a manufacturer in a tasting room is only alcohol that we produce ourselves. So we did switch our license this year with COVID, being able to do cocktails to go. We were upgrading our license, so we have a full bar license now, so we can have other spirits on site. But up until this year, we weren't allowed to do that. So it was gin, juice, syrup, and bitters. That's all we could do. So something like the bee's knees is really perfect for that situation. It's just, you know, honey and lemon. And it's also really delicious. It's, you know, simplistic, but so many classic cocktails are. Like Tom Collins is simple and lemon and club soda. And, you know, French 75 that you did an episode earlier on is lemon and simple and champagne and gin. And it's, you know, it's there's a lot of versatility.
So good.
Even between just, you know, two or three ingredients. So yeah, we have served the bee's knees here and we've done, I think, three different variations on it. We had one last spring called the green bee, which was not infused necessarily. We used fresh sage leaves while we build the cocktail. So we just tore the leaves up in the shaker and then shook the hell out of it like a gimlet to really get the oils into it. And we also... One that's been really, really popular is our Kind of Blue cocktail. It's named after the Miles Davis album. We have this 1961 record console that we play all our music on at the tasting room, which honestly at the beginning was like more of a draw than the gin for certain people. So it's it's this very nice mid-century gorgeous thing. Anyway, so we have a lot of LPs and so it just sort of fit with the name. But that particular cocktail is just a classic bee's knees using a little bit of a blueberry phosphate that's made by a local bitters company, Owl and Whale. And we really like that one because as a phosphate, it has an acid base instead of an alcohol base like a bitters. And so the blueberry flavor due to that acid has a really nice, bright, natural flavor to it. Blueberry in particular can get really sort of, you know, soapy, candly, even if it is a all natural flavoring, just because you lose that acid, you lose the brightness, it just goes south really fast. But something about that acid base just preserves the freshness of the flavor. So for that one, it just adds a nice hint of sweetness and a little bit extra acid to cut through the honey. And that's been one of our best sellers for a couple of years. We bring it back every summer.
Well, that sounds fantastic. Mia, you had a question.
I kind of answered my own question in my head. I was going to say, are you for all of your cocktails that you're making based off of the bee's knees, are you using your generic gin, obviously, like your house, I'm going to call it your house gin versus like a flavored kind or like a coconut? It's obviously coming from the original, right?
So most of our, I don't know, like everyone else, our business is sort of split into pre and post COVID. But we used to be open six nights a week for drinks. We were just, you know, a cocktail bar. We didn't open till 4. So we weren't really like a, you know, 11 to 5, here's a t-shirt, we'll never see you again kind of thing. So for us, we did try to have more of a developed cocktail menu when we were open. And so we were featuring all 4 of the gins in particular cocktails. I mean, I think our last menu was 16 drinks. And then we also used to do these gin and tonic flights. So we'd actually amassed, I think, 16 different tonic varieties, some bottled, some as like syrup concentrates. And we would offer a flight so people could get 4 half-size gin and tonics and try out the different ones because they all have different flavors or botanical ingredients depending on the brand and variety. And so for us, it really became about, you know, again, since we couldn't introduce too many new flavors in the form of like other spirits doing classic cocktails like Martini Negroni, we couldn't have those ingredients here. So we had to pair the flavors in different ways. And so we definitely would sort of split the 4, well, at the time, 3 spirits equally on the menu, just depending on the cocktail.
Wow. So you really couldn't, like, you couldn't make a Negroni?
Nope.
That's such a bummer.
Juice, syrup, Negroni. That's it. Well, we can now.
You can now. This is during COVID. You got this expanded license to do that.
Yes. Yep. It was something that we had in the back of our minds for this year before everything happened, because we had, you know, we had been functioning as a cocktail bar essentially for the last 5 years, and we wanted to be able to expand our offerings. It just was a little bit nebulous in a way as far as the new requirements we would have to meet to have an upgraded license. And so, you know, when COVID happened, we decided it would be worth it just to be able to have that variety and be able to do the drinks to go, because tasting rooms are one of the last licenses to have that option, just because they were intending there to be a food requirement with cocktails to go. And most tasting rooms don't have a food program. That's something that we were able to not do under the tasting room license originally. I mean, we had like little bar snacks and stuff, but we never, you know, had a kitchen or anything like that. It wasn't part of what we had to do.
So you're the first maker we've talked to on this podcast, and I would be remiss if I didn't ask, what other aspects of your business did you have to shift dramatically to deal with COVID-19?
Oof. Well, a lot. I mean, it was...
Sorry, if it's too traumatic. We don't have to talk about it.
It's not too traumatic. It's for us in particular, it was sort of twofold. We, you know, we've been open for, we turned five back in June. So we've been open for 5.5 years. And for us, the two main problems were our wholesale distribution, because bars and restaurants across the country closed. And we do have a lot of on-premise customers in Maine and other states. We distribute to 12 states currently. And so that was a big hit with everyone just closing. Like, no one was doing any service whatsoever for several months. And then here at our tasting room location, we, you know, had a staff of four. We were open 6 nights a week. It was, you know, just a neighborhood hang for a lot of people. And that changed overnight, basically. Like, I was having a conversation with another business owner the other day about how we're coming up on a year almost of this, and how uncertain everything was even just at the beginning. Like, I was recounting the weekend. It was basically the same 48-hour period that everyone in the state seemed to say, okay, we need to close. This is what we're supposed to do. Like, you know, we were out to dinner on Friday and we noticed the tables were a little spaced further apart than normal. And like, there were like 6 feet between all the bar stools. And we're like, yeah, everyone's probably going to start closing this weekend. And then the next day we thought, well, okay, we'll spread our tables out. You know, our manager sent out this long text message of all these new cleaning procedures we wanted to do after, you know, every time a guest left or went to the bathroom or something like that, just like disinfecting every surface. And then Sunday we were like, okay, nope, we have to close completely. This is not, you know, it was in 72 hours. It was like, huh, I wonder what's going to happen to like, nope, we're closing. Like, we posted about our St. Patrick's Day special on Saturday, because it was the following Tuesday, and then like Sunday we closed.
So wild.
It was right before St. Patrick's Day. I remember that because I was walking my dog up and down our main street in Beacon, and all the signs were like St. Patrick's Day specials, and it was May. Yeah. Like, people still hadn't reopened their bars. And I was like, oh God, we're living in some sort of weird twilight zone where it's just, it's always St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah.
It's just stuck in St. Patrick's Day land. Wow. So how did you find that you like got back into a groove over the summer, and then things just started to feel a little more normal, or does it still just feel odd and strange?
It's a little more normal now, just because things haven't changed too much since late summer, early fall. So we didn't actually start doing cocktails to go until the beginning of September. So for us, closing completely in March, we, because, I don't know, just because of the way the different business licenses are categorized, we were technically considered an essential business. And so we were allowed to stay open in a retail capacity. So we shifted all of our inventory to a website through Square that we use for our point of sale. we gave our bartenders as close to the same amount of hours as we were before, as much as we could. And basically just opened the door, put a table in front of the door so no one could come into the room. And people were just ordering online for pickup or curbside. So, you know, retail bottles, t-shirts, things like that. Took us about a week to figure out we could do little drink kits that didn't have the alcohol in them and sell those to people. So it was like, you know, DIY cocktail. If you have a bottle at home, you know, here's a pre-portioned serving of the favorite drink that you used to order. So we basically put our menu into like little plastic souffle cups. But yeah, and then that evolved into 16-ounce bottles of drink mix, and then bringing in more like barware, home products, things like that for people to buy. And we basically just had to turn into a store.
Right. Did you ever think you'd have to do that?
No. I mean, we honestly, we'd always tried to minimize our retail section just because it, you know, took up space where a table could be. So, but now like the entire room is, I've, you know, gone to IKEA in Massachusetts like four times to get more shelves to bring in more stuff. And it's,
it's, you go together and you're still together? That's impressive.
I, no, I always go alone. It's sort of great. Me time.
See, you're smart. Yeah. This is why you're the boss. This is why you're the boss. Well, I'm happy that you were able to transform your space into something that worked and kept you open and alive. Your product is amazing. So I'm very happy that you're still up and running, making gin, selling your pre-made cocktails, able to do cocktails to go. I think the ability of people to bounce back and shift really quickly their business model is impressive, and it tells a lot about you and the other people and like restaurant owners and makers having to deal with this crisis. And kudos, because it's tough, and especially for you employ people and you have to look them in the eye and tell them the hard truth about stuff. So I'm not trying to re-traumatize you.
No. No, I get it. Yeah, no, it's been a tough year, and it's I mean, I tell people it could have been worse. I mean, we're okay. We have gotten a lot of assistance through grants and emergency loans, which have helped. But we're, you know, just one day at a time is sort of the mentality now. So
that's a good, that's the only advice you can really give anymore.
Yeah.
Right.
Just one day at a time. Don't freak yourself out like for no reason. I remember when it was like two weeks. That's a funny thing to think back on.
Oh God. I was so hopeful. I was just like, if everyone just stay home, like maybe, like I even told my staff, like, all right, we're going to close, but hopefully this 2 week thing works and, you know, we'll like launch the spring menu and it'll be fine. It was just like, no.
Remember those days?
Yeah.
What a fun time that was. This little fantasy land we all lived in.
Ugh.
All right. So segueing out of COVID, I have a pre-prepared question here. So what tips or words of advice would you give to aspiring distillers or makers?
I would give them the same advice that we received from another craft distillery, which was be certain you want to do this. It is a very tricky market to get into. That's something that we were a little naive about, to be honest with you. Make sure that the product is something that you love and you believe in, and that you have something unique to add to the larger craft spirits universe. It is tricky to make headway. When, you know, Prohibition was repealed, it was repealed in such a way that only the big boys could open again. There were, you know, thousands of distilleries in this country before Prohibition. It was, you know, every farmer had a farm distiller's license so he could turn his, you know, surplus grain into something that was more shelf stable and more valuable. But so after the repeal, it really stayed that way. And the, you know, international alcohol business is really a money game. I mean, there are so many just international conglomerates that control, I think they still control like 97% of market share. And so that's, as a small producer, that's sort of what you're up against. And, you know, obviously, thankfully, there is a large community of people who are really interested in people like us, the small scale makers who, you know, have a hand in everything, who really are committed to quality and transparency. And so we've been able to form a lot of great partnerships and relationships through that. But there are definitely places where you get shut out. And so you can't take it personally.
Right.
So don't take it personally. Know your message. Stay on message.
Yeah. Yeah.
Be unique.
Stick to it.
Stick to it.
Yes. Just
keep going. Mm-hmm. I'd say what I've gotten out of what you guys have done.
Yeah.
Do so your damn thing.
Yeah. Do your thing. Here's my last question. What is your favorite gin cocktail?
Oh boy.
Yeah. I did that. I asked that.
You did. I don't know why I didn't anticipate that, but no.
I threw one in there.
Honestly, I really love a dry martini.
Mmm. Good answer.
Nice and simple.
Nice and simple.
And I will say,
but it's made badly, terrible.
Oh, great. Right. I ordered one at a restaurant once, and it was inedible. I don't know what the hell they did to it. It was god awful. I don't know how. It's just gin and vermouth, but it was not okay.
The worst. Maybe they left the vermouth out, and it got warm behind that bar.
Probably. Yeah.
A lot of people do that with their vermouth.
Yeah. For like 3 years.
I don't know why people treat vermouth so badly, but people tend to just leave it on the speed rack.
They really do.
It's atrocious. Well, Christina, thank you so much for joining us. It was such a pleasure to talk to you. You can find Bimini Gin and Christina on Instagram at Bimini Gin, that's B-I-M-I-N-I Gin, and at Round Turn Distilling. And visit BiminiGin.com to see where you can snag a bottle. I did. It was easy. I went on there. I found a place in Brooklyn, drove down there, bing, bang, boom, got myself a bottle of coconut gin. It was easy peasy.
Great.
But Christina, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes,
it was such
you.
A pleasure talking to you and getting to know you.
Well, thanks for having me. It was fun.
Yeah. And when the snow stops falling, me and Mia will have to take a road trip up and come visit.
Please do.
I would love to.
Yeah. When the weather warms up and we can snag a to-go cocktail or something, or barge our way in.
Oh, yeah.
So, anyway, well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, I can't wait to make more cocktails with your gin and try everything else that you make in the future.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah. All right, folks, that is our show. Thanks so much for joining us. Stop by next week. We're going to be talking about National Absinthe Day. So we're going to be discussing all things The Little Green Fairy. I'm your host, Alexa Wilkinson.
And I'm your co-host, Mia Fiorito.
And this is Drink History.
Drink History.
Drink History is produced by me, Alex Wilkinson, and our theme song is by Blue Topaz. Episodes will be released every Wednesday and distributed by Anchor.fm. Visit drinkhistorypodcast.com for more info and help us out by sharing and rate and listen where all podcasts are available. And also feel free to leave a voicemail on Anchor and let us know how you feel about the show or just any questions or comments for us. We'd love to hear from you. All right, folks, cheers.